Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to our second Backlisted special. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund books they really want to read. And although today I'm not joined for once by my literary partner in virtue, Andy Miller, I'm delighted to welcome a true friend of the show returning for her record-breaking ninth appearance, the writer Una McCormack. Hello, Una.
Hi, John. Very good to be here.
Well, very, very good to have you. And we have, as they say, a fully packed show. But for those people who don't know who Una from previous, I can't believe there's anybody who hasn't heard Una on a previous Backlisted. But Una is the author of nearly two dozen science fiction novels based on TV shows such as Star Trek, Doctor Who, Firefly and Blake 7. Her most recent books include The Autobiography of Mr. Spock and Star Trek Picard Second Self. She's on the editorial board of Gold SF, an imprint of Goldsmiths Press aimed at publishing new voices in intersectional feminist science fiction, of more anon. Their first publications are Mathematics for Ladies by Jessie Randall and Empathy by Hoa Pham. Now, the format of these Backlisted specials differ from the main show in that they feature a guest choosing a number of books in an area they know and care about. So today, amazingly enough, Una has selected five of the science fiction novels which helped make her the writer that she is today. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about five different books. Five, I have to say, some of them I'd heard of, some of them I hadn't. Some of them read, some of them I hadn't. But they all, taken as a whole, it's an extraordinary list.
Good. Well, I'm glad about that. I toyed with doing recipe books, but I can't cook. So I could have done a Le Guin, actually, if we'd done recipe books. She's got recipes in one of Finn Always Coming Home. But no, I thought, let's stick with science fiction.
Although, is there possibly the publisher, you see my little publisher kind of antennae beginning to sort of twitch there. Is there a science fiction cookbook at some point in the future? Who knows?
Yeah, well, all these little pellets of food or something. Yeah.
Yeah. What's first on your pile, Una?
So when I was thinking about these, I thought, lots of people don't read science fiction. So should I sort of come up with a list that, this is kind of your gateway? And then I thought, nah, I'm just going to go straight in with the hard crack.
So. And I have to say, I'm really glad. I am someone who, I am not a science, and I should say that to everybody. This is a conversation that is not between two science fiction kind of aficionados. I would say that my kind of taste and interest in sci-fi was probably, like a lot of my generation, kindled by Puffin books, by Arthur C. Clarke of Time and Stars, of reading Asimov, Foundation Trilogy at school. And it kind of developed in parallel to my interest in fantasy, reading Tolkien in particular. And it didn't tip over into there were kids at school who were reading, who were reading kind of the magazines and really getting into the kind of the harder end of sci-fi, which I didn't go. So I've very much got, a general reader's impression of science fiction rather than a sort of specialist inside knowledge.
in many ways, that's my reading experience too, because I found that there's quite a fixed canon, or there has been in the past with science fiction. And I found when I got to Asimov, didn't like the sexual politics, didn't like the politics. And again, I would kind of run up against this with the kind of science fiction that people go, oh, you must read this, you must read this. It's the canon, this is what you must read. And so I kind of started to come in sideways and pick up books that were... I would always pick up a book if it had a woman author. So that was a starting point. I go, I'll give that a crack. And so my journey into it was quite sideways as well. So I think it overlaps a lot with my interest in utopian fiction. My background as a sociologist, so I found I was reading as a sociologist as much as someone who was interested in prose style. I'll forgive quite a lot of inelegancy in a science fiction novel if the ideas are good enough. So the books I've kind of picked kind of track my journey in a way. Some of them people will know. I'll be amazed if there's anyone who's read all five of these, possibly some of my friends.
But that's exactly what these specials are for, is to come at subjects. I mean, it would be very easy to say the five greatest science fiction novels of all time, and I'm sure we've probably all got a list of those. But this is not that. It's much more interesting, and I have to say, I found it so interesting, delving deeply. So, where are we starting?
We're starting with 10-year-old Una McCormack in, I think I'm in Eccleston Library in St Helens. And a shout out to Frank Cottrell Boyce, yes, the other St Helens.
You don't have to come from St Helens to be on this,
but it helps.
This podcast, but it helps.
A credit to Notre Dame and West Park education system, I think, of the 70s and 80s. So I'm in Eccleston Library. I pick up a curious book called The Far Side of Evil by Sylvia Engdahl, which had a very, very striking cover of a sort of a young woman's head with a kind of cutaway, like a model. You can look into her brain. You see somebody is spying on her thoughts. So I picked this to represent my pre-teen reading, because I think we get science fiction at that sort of age. And I loved this book. I had this book out of the library again and again and again and again and again. Something about it really, 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 really captured my imagination. It's not an easy read. It's a very bleak book in many ways. It deals with issues such as, well, there's quite an extensive passage about sensory deprivation, which I'm amazed I got to read this book. So it concerns a young woman who's a sort of representative of quite a sophisticated intergalactic power. And what they do is they send anthropological agents to visit worlds that are not quite as, well, I'll say developed, but, you know, let's just use that language. And she's observing this world, which is on the verge of nuclear war. And what they're interested in is this idea of the critical stage, which is a point in a kind of civilization's history where they'll either blow themselves up or divert their talents to other interests like space travel. And there they're studying this. And this world is very close to blowing itself up. And a thriller ensues. And our character has to stay undercover throughout.
And, I mean, the interesting thing about Engdahl, who I had encountered as a, probably in the early 70s through the Puffin list. And there's a book called Heritage of the Star that Puffin published. But what I hadn't realised until I started to read for this podcast was she really believes in this... in this critical stage of civilization, and that she's a strong believer that in the colonization of space, and amazing woman who's still alive and still regularly updating her website.
Incredibly, yeah.
Yeah. I found that really interesting, the idea that these books aren't just kind of, they're not metaphorical. She really believes.
Absolutely, there's a kind of proselytizing aspect to them as well. Perhaps more measured than an Elon Musk. But that's definitely there in her fiction. And I think what this book gave me is I went on to do a PhD in sociology. And I think what this book gave me, along with Le Guin, who I was reading at the same time, was it gave me some of the kind of mental apparatus to start thinking that way. oh, societies can change. Well, oh, she suggests they have kind of levels of development. Well, you would believe that now if you're a sociologist, you kind of drop that idea quite quickly. But it gives you the kind of brain work to be able to think in that way. And that, for me, is what science fiction is all right. If I'm reading good science fiction, I can feel the synapses rewiring. It's doing something to my mind. It's making me think differently. And that's what really good science fiction should do. If it gets to you at 10, you're set.
and it's an interesting, the two things that also on that Engdahl. One is the difficulty of, she writes about when she first started writing in the late 60s and early 70s, having novels published, there wasn't a category called young adult. Knowing what's right, I noticed the Puffin, who were usually pretty loose on these things, just said for Heritage of the Star, which was written after Far Side of Evil, that just said an exciting, demanding and thought-provoking tale of the future for older readers.
Older readers. Well, in I went online in the sort of mid-90s and I found her website because, like you said, she sort of, you know, she really was an early adopter of the web. And I emailed her and said, you know, oh, God, this is really exciting. I think it's the first time I contacted a writer like that. And I said, I adored this book. It meant so much to me. I read it when I was 10 years old. And I got this email back saying, you read this book at 10? Oh, my God. There's no way that should have been in your hands by any stretch of the imagination. You should have been about 13 or 14, older readers. Yeah, exactly this kind of category of a young adult. I think what they were called in science fiction, they were called juveniles, weren't they? If you kind of got to Heinlein,
yeah,
you were reading a juvenile. Yeah.
Obviously, it's, as you say, it's got a cracking plot. And it is, as you say, it is sort of quite bleak. There's a sort of love story that, spoiler alert, doesn't end out quite as...
No, I think the love story perhaps isn't the strongest part. I think the relationship between her, Ilana, the lead, and her female friend, Kari, who knows nothing about the real situation, is probably one of the best bits of the book. You learn about placebo effects from that narrative as well. It's another thing this book gave me. So all sorts going on.
Yeah, because I mean, she was a computer programmer, I think. Well, early computer programmer, Sylvia Engdahl. And I love that she says in one of the notes on the book, she says, some readers thought I used space fiction as a vehicle for political commentary, whereas in fact, I use political melodrama to dramatise ideas about the importance of space.
There's a lot of science fiction writers do this, I think, kind of, you know. And I think the way she gets away with it is that I think when science fiction becomes too didactic, obviously the prose is going to suffer. But I never feel that her prose is bad. There might be lengthy sections like there are in 1984 of, you know, opinion A being countered by opinion B. But yeah, that's the grand tradition of, that's Hitler Day and, you know, it's utopia, isn't it? But there's always a good story around it, I think.
Is there a bit that you can read, do you think, that would give us a...
Yeah, I won't spoil it, but I'll just read the start, which I think, imagine me.
I think she's just a really good writer.
They're good on a kind of sentence level, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. And also, it's just, you know, proper page turner. I mean, I really raced through this one.
Good, I'm glad. It's a book that deserves to survive, I think.
And, you know, the whole space thing is like, I mean, the idea is that it's almost like an evolutionary thing that she thinks, isn't it? That we get to a certain point in our development as a species where we need to colonise other. And she's very interesting. She's very clear that she doesn't think we should be colonising places that are inhabited by other races or species. She's anti-imperialist in that way, that we should be expanding in order to, it's almost like it's sort of spiking the guns of aggression and overcrowding and the ruination of the planet. She keeps updating it. She updated it for 9/11 and then she updates it for the climate emergency, that this idea is we need to get into space, but, you know, not in a kind of, as you say, in a sort of ghastly Elon Musk kind of way.
Yeah, and don't take the same problems, but use it as a diversion of energy into something better, which I think is good. And I think at the back of her mind, secretly, like all of us, she thinks that if we just get out there, then the Vulcans will come past and introduce us to a massive galactic federation.
Yeah. genuine alternative.
Exactly.
Genuine alternative universe. Yeah, great.
Should I read the start?
Yeah, go on, go on. It's good.
So we join our protagonist, Alana, partway through the story, we find very quickly that she's been imprisoned. So I'll read a little bit of it. The wind is howling through the trees outside, a cold, hateful wind. By standing on the bunk, I can just barely reach the window. It's quite dark now and the stars are brilliant, though they seem terribly far away. They, at least, are familiar and comforting, a reminder of home. There's no use pretending I'm not scared. I'm in prison, and I do not think that I shall get out. I'm not guilty of the charges against me. I'm not at all what my interrogators think I am. They know nothing of my real identity beyond my first name, Alana, and the fact that I seem to be a surprisingly young girl to be involved in a sabotage plot. They'd be even more surprised if they knew the truth.
That's great. And again, I, you know, one of the other things I like about, although she does have kind of telepathic capabilities, that there isn't that kind of, there isn't that sort of deus ex machina thing that I dislike in a lot of fantasy of, you know, I can do real proper magic and I can do. And in that sense, she reminds me of your next choice.
Well, what can we say about the great Ursula Le Guin, eh? I think, you know, when you asked me to do this, I said, shall we just do 5 Le Guin books or shall I? Yeah, because we very, very easily could have done that. And I really hummed and hawed about which one to do. But at the end of the day, it could only be The Dispossessed, which I'm holding up in my beautiful, beautiful edition, which is a very cheap paperback, completely in black, a beautiful red anarchy symbol. And that's what The Dispossessed is. It's Le Guin's working through in novel form of the political philosophy of anarchism. It's Le Guin's. I think she does 2 novels back to back, Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed, and I think they're just exceptionally good. People tend to like one more than the other, you know, they love both, but there's one that particularly speaks to them. And it's The Dispossessed that spoke to me. I love it. Never tire of this book.
One of the things that's interesting about science fiction is it goes right back, doesn't it, to the beginnings of the novel form. If you think of Francis Bacon's Utopia or Jonathan Swift's, that's Utopian. Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, it isn't a utopian, but it has that kind of other worlds, other peoples, that kind of that attempt to try and understand social organization, political organization, political philosophy through placing it in places that aren't real, that aren't part of our kind of known reality. And I agree. I think The Dispossessed, I always thought I preferred The Left Hand of Darkness, but having reread The Dispossessed for this,
it's beautiful, isn't it? It's so elegant.
I mean, and this is properly beautifully, beautifully written. I mean, it's a great novel. It's just a great novel. It's not a great science fiction novel. It's one of the great modern novels. But I mean, we should say a little bit about what it is, because one of the great things about this is there are some of those sort of trip to the moon type utopian novels, or even news from nowhere by William Morris, are annoying because the utopia is too utopian.
Yeah,
and actually, this is what's genius about The Dispossessed is Anaris, the planet that is the anarcho-syndicalist planet, is far from perfect.
It's gone rotten, hasn't it? Something is rotten in the state there. Yeah, and she, I think the subtitle that's on some editions is An Ambiguous Utopia. So, and I think this is what part of what she's doing in this book is saying again and again, utopia isn't a blueprint. Okay, utopia is practice. Utopia is method. Utopia is a way of being in the world. It's something that we carry with us. And when the lead, Shevik, leaves his failing utopia or his troubled utopia, Anaris, and goes to Urus, he still carries with him the principles that he was brought up with. He carries the utopianism with him. So that's the point of the book, I think, is that utopia is not something we can just leave achieve and then, you know, leave to get on with things. Utopia is a kind of constancy, a way of being in the world and a way of keeping these principles going in everyday interactions. I can't tell people listening how much I love this book and how much they're going to get from it. Consume it.
Some interesting things that come up having reread it again. And Uras is the opposite in many ways, isn't it? It's incredibly opulent place, but it's patriarchal and it's definitely capitalist. And they dress in these, in, you know, the, everything, the food and the clothing is kind of very elegant. And but he turns on them. It reminds me. I'm always reminded of kind of the those brilliant artists that came out of the Soviet Union with Le Guin. You know, that he's kind of, he aspires towards the sort of the what you might call the Western opulence, but in his heart he also believes in the kind of there's a brilliant bit where he turns around and accuses the Ura Esti of, you are all in jail, each alone, solitary, with a heap of what he owns. You live in prison, die in prison. It is all I can see in your eyes, the wall being also a really important metaphor for
the central message, bit of T.S. Eliot,
but
there, isn't
it? It's that idea that that they are just as much. I mean, you know, that they're sort of prisoners for all their kind of apparent freedom.
Exactly that, yeah. And he comes to this place, and it makes no sense to him. The ordinary ways that people behave are just, they seem insane to him, that people allow these kinds of permissions over themselves. In his own mind, he remains free.
But if you, when you go back to the other way, the society comes from, he is also kind of, I mean, he's a brilliant scientist, and without going into the whole plot, he's kind of, he clashes with authority, doesn't he? The whole idea in Anaris is that the children aren't allowed to talk about anything that's interesting to them. They have to talk about stuff that's interesting to others. Anything that's interesting to you is called egoizing.
Egoizing, yes, or hanging on to things. The worst you can sort of say to people is that, although that's so proprietarian of you. And I think what has happened on Anaris is that perhaps with any sort of revolutionary group, you know, the pieties and the show of it, the performance of it, has become more important than the actuality. So Shevik is sort of driven away because people are jealous of his talent, and they think that you know, they make him feel unwelcome because they make him feel that his talent has no place. He's not being part of the group. He's trying to get special preferential treatments, which is the reason he leaves and goes to Uras. But there are a lot of very pious people on Anaris, and a lot of people for whom the revolution is lip service rather than lived reality, which is one reason he goes. Well, I won't spoil the plot because I think people really should read it.
I'll get you to read a little bit in a moment. But I did want to, just one thing that it's less ambiguous than I thought it was about the role of women. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of, I mean, it has had criticism from some feminist critics as being kind of, that Shevek is very much, he was based apparently on Oppenheimer, her father knew, yeah. And that it's kind of, it's a big, you know, it's a sort of male hero, and the although Odon, who is the kind of the founder of the anarchist philosophy on Anaris, is a woman. It seems to me that that didn't spoil my enjoyment of the book, but I just wondered.
My feeling with Le Guin is that feminism is a second language to her. It's something that she learns through writing science fiction, through getting critiques from people like Joanna Ross, who was a first language speaker of feminism. And this book is 74. We're just hitting the middle of the women's movement. And by the time you get to a book like Tahanu, which completely subverts Earthsea, Le Guin is fluent in feminism. And you see this transition in her work. And she takes Earthsea, And she goes, it's not good enough. I've made mistakes here. I'm going to work with this. I'm going to change this. And I, Tahanu, I think, is one of her best books, which is the fourth book of Earthsea. I know some people don't like it. They are wrong.
That's what we like. That's the kind of opinion we like on Backlisted, as you know. Brilliant. And it was 74. Yeah. It was published Harper and Row in the States, Gallants, obviously, in the UK. Do you want to just read a little just to give us, because I do think that one of the great joys of this book is the prose. I mean, it really is beautiful.
Absolutely. And I think we sort of referred to her her father before, who was a very eminent anthropologist, Theodore Kroeber. I like to think that this sort of comes from Le Guin watching her father. And her husband, of course, is a retired academic. So this is when Shevet gets to Uruk and he's at the university and he starts teaching. They were superbly trained, these students. Their minds were fine, keen, ready, and when they weren't working, they rested. They were not blunted and distracted by a dozen obligations. They never fell asleep in class. Their society maintained them in complete freedom from want, distraction and cares. What they were free to do, however, was another question. It appeared to Shevik that their freedom from obligation was in exact proportion to their lack of freedom of initiative. He was appalled by the examination system when it was explained to him. He could not imagine a greater deterrent to the natural wish to learn than this pattern of cramming information, disgorging it at demand. At first, he refused to give any tests or grades, but this upset the university administrators so badly that, not wishing to be discourteous to his host, he gave in. He asked his students to write a paper on any problem in physics that interested them and told them he'd give them all the highest marks so the bureaucrats would have something to write on their forms. A good many students came to him to complain. They wanted him to set problems, to ask the right questions. They didn't want to think about questions, but to write down the answers they had learned. Some of them objected strongly to his giving everyone the same mark. How could the diligent students be distinguished from the dull ones? What was the good in working hard? If no competitive distinctions were to be made, one might as well do nothing. Well, of course, Shevik said, troubled. If you do not want to do the work, you shouldn't do it.
Oh, so good.
She's great. Yeah,
you know, that reminds me of that. I don't know, whoever is the education is the process by which the notes of the professor are reproduced in the notebooks of the students without passing through the minds of either.
So that, exactly.
I think Shevek is a fantastic, rich and complex character as well.
Really interesting. I did a fantastic panel on this book with Francis Spufford was part of it, and a wonderful physicist from Cambridge called Gina Halabi, and we had her there to talk about that the physics was any good. She said, do you know what, let's pass a veil over the physics because the novel is good.
You definitely get, yes. I mean, the thing is, although, you know, there is more, we'll come on to more or less convincing use of physics in other books we're going to talk about.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
The third choice is what, Una?
So I decided to pick something by Octavia Butler. I thought I won't go with the novels for which she's best known. I'm going to go with the short Kindred and Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents. I'm going to go for her short stories. So she hardly wrote any short stories, half a dozen, I think. And they're all collected in a wonderful publication called Blood Child and Other Stories. Now, the thing about Butler, who are probably one of the best post-war American science fiction, sort of post-60s American science fiction
and
writers.
And a multi-award winning, like Le Guin, won Nebulas, won Hugos.
Exactly, I mean,
won everything going.
Genius grants, genius awards, yeah.
And was for a long time, probably the only, certainly the most prominent woman of colour writing science fiction.
Exactly. Yeah. I think there was her and Delaney, but for a long time. So absolutely trailblazing, I think. And her early death, I think, was a shattering blow. I think we all feel there would have been another Parables novel. There would have been a sequel to another novel. In these short stories, you can see the germs of novels that were emerging. And she never thought of herself as a short story writer. And yet, I think so there's maybe 6 short stories in this, and 3 of them pick up awards.
I mean, I was going to say, because in a way, again, one of the things, the engines of science fiction publishing and
yep.
has been the short story, the great magazine culture of the 50s and 60s. That was a sort of international movement. I mean, we've talked about the Strugatsky brothers on Backlisted, that short stories were the sort of the kind of the currency.
Absolutely, continue to be. I mean, it still has a strong both paper and online magazine. That's still there. I think some of these magazines are still going. Asimov's is still going. Fantasy and SF is still going. You've got online places like Strange Horizons now. But I think people feel it's your apprenticeship in science fiction, that you chip away at a handful of shorts. The award, you know, people still get awards. They're still very prestigious. It's almost unique in a way. I can't think of another genre in which that happens.
Some of them, I think, are, you know, they're barely even, I would say, science fiction. There's one of them that is, I think it's called Crossover. But you can't get past the first one, which is one of the most terrifying and brilliant and weird. She's such an extraordinary writer, isn't she? I mean, I previously had read Kindred, but this is, and I know Andy's talked to about her, but this is something else. Do you want to give us the hideous pitch?
Yeah. So a little context to this. I taught creative writing for a long time, and I taught a course on the short story. And I was starting to get bored with the science fiction stories I picked. So I kind of threw it out to the internet, as you do. And they said, well, you've got to do Bloodchild by Octavia Butler. That'll raise
them. That'll sort, as it were, the worms from the flies.
Them, yeah. The humans from the tlick. So I went and had a read of it. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to... Oh, can I? And then I thought, certainly can. Yeah, so I gave them this short story. I think it's worth saying that it's visceral, it's shocking, it's inspired by an unpleasant encounter that the author had with a bot fly,
which lays its eggs under the skin, and you're in order to get rid of it without inducing infection, you're supposed to allow the maggot to hatch.
Exactly that, and from this quite unpleasant material, she generates a horrifying and unflinching and relentless short story about what it means to be living in a sort of symbiotic relationship with another species. I don't really want to give this story away in many ways. I think people should sit and read it. I can read the start.
I mean, things that I would say about it are that it's weirdly erotic. Which it really shouldn't be. I mean, this is like Gregor Samsa actually ending up in a relationship with a human in his insect-like form. As you say, the tlick are kind of farming humans to carry their eggs. And that sounds obviously awful and grotesque, and it is, but they groom them emotionally as well as physically, so there's a closeness and a tenderness.
Yes, there is, and it's not like they're animals. It's more like they're part of the household. Yeah, she was very resistant to people saying that this was an allegory for slavery, and I think she's right. It's a much more nuanced story than that. She called it a love story, which I think is a really, you know, but people should read it. And read the whole collection. Speech Sounds is about a pandemic.
Yes. Where people lose the ability to speak. And the very long, The Evening and the Morning and the Night, which is another one about a disease which is called DGD, which calls a dissociative state characterized by violent psychosis and self-harm.
I mean, there's no pity in these stories. Yeah. There, I saw a remark online, the writer Shweta Narayan, she says that you know, the novels are unflinching, but Butler's short stories are all bone. And that's exactly right. Everything is pared down. Her prose style is already really pared down. But in the short stories, nothing's wasted. So, yeah. Shall we have the start? What do you think?
Go for it. I mean, I would say there is curiously, they're tough, but there is weirdly hope.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. They're all about taking, humans in the worst situations. How can we live in this? And not just endure, but find a means to thrive, I think, to find love and hope. Let's give them the start and then see if they go and read it. My last night of childhood began with a visit home. Tagatoy's sister had given us two sterile eggs. Tagatoy gave one to my mother, brother and sisters. She insisted that I eat the other one alone. It didn't matter. There was still enough to leave everyone feeling good. Almost everyone. My mother wouldn't take any. She sat, watching everyone drifting and dreaming without her. Most of the time, she watched me. I lay against Tagatoy's long velvet underside, sipping from my egg now and then, wondering why my mother denied herself such a harmless pleasure. Less of her hair would be grey if she indulged now and then. The eggs prolong life, prolong vigour. My father, who'd never refused one in his life, had lived more than twice as long as he should have. And toward the end of his life, when he should have been slowing down, he'd married my mother and fathered four children. But my mother seemed content to age before she had to. I saw her turn away as several of Tagatoy's limbs secured me closer. Tagatoy liked our body heat and took advantage of it whenever she could. When I was little and at home more, my mother used to try and tell me how to behave, to be respectful and obedient. Tagatoy was the Tlik government official in charge of the preserve, and thus the most important of her kind. It was an honour, my mother said, that such a person had chosen to come into the family. My mother was at her most formal and severe when she was lying.
I mean, just the more you read by and about Octavia Butler, the more admirable she becomes, I think. And I particularly loved, there's an essay called Furor Scribendi, which is kind of like the fury or the anger of a writer. She said that the most important habit, it's kind of writing tips, the most important habit a writer has is persistence. That's more important than talent and inspiration or even imagination.
Yeah. There's a wonderful thing that goes around, which is her kind of manifesto to herself, her promises that she makes herself. You will write. You will win awards. You will be successful. You will achieve. You will be known. Your stories will not be forgotten. It's incredible in her own handwriting as well.
Just before we move on, because I did think, and this will come out in the next book we're going to talk about, is that some people have said, whether, you know, that they're obviously, I think that it's too easy just to say, oh, this is a story about slavery, and that must be deeply annoying. But she did say that the idea of being able to imagine, for Black people to be able to imagine themselves in a reality that isn't defined by the history that they have is why science fiction works for them. And it strikes me that must be an issue too for other people who feel that they have been excluded from the mainstream of history. And I wondered if that was a good way of you just saying a little bit about what you're doing in your sort of publishing role.
Yes. So what we're doing with Gold SF is back in the 80s, the Women's Press had a list which was a science fiction list. So I think we all know the Women's Press kind of black and white zigzag spines. With the iron, yes, steaming ahead. But the spines I looked out for were the grey ones.
Yeah.
And that was the feminist science fiction list. And I think over about 6 or 7 years, they published maybe 33 dozen science fiction novels. It's the first time that Joanna Russ is printed in Britain. And I came across these in a little box of books in Newnham JCR in 1991. There was a collection of short stories by Lisa Tuttle. And, you know, you find something like this and you go, oh, right, these are the things I'm meant to be reading rather than all this stuff people's giving me. So I've been hunting these down over and over and over the years. And then around about just a couple of years, but about 18 months before lockdown, a friend of mine at Goldsmiths, Sarah Kemba, who's the director of Goldsmiths Press, we met at a talk I was giving about feminist science fiction. And we kind of looked at each other and we went, why don't we do this again? You know, because this list was incredible. It put voices into print that didn't get heard. It gave people a sort of space in which they could experiment both with prose and ideas and styles. We could do this. You know, you've got the press. I've got the... Let's put on the show right here. And this is exactly what we're trying to do with Goldsmiths, with Goldlitter.
It's like Lucy Scholes wrote a brilliant piece in Prospect about the archive hunters. You know, people are out there who... And she said what Carmen Khalil had said about Virago is that Virago will never... That will never end. That process is not... You don't get to, oh, we've done all the undiscovered women writers now. Because, in fact, what happens is, as we're about to go, as we're about to find out, your next book, undiscovered writers of science fiction, be they male or female, are always coming out of the woodwork.
Absolutely. Male, female, or indeed persons, as my fourth book is very much about. So I've picked a novel called Proud Man by a writer called Catherine Burdekin. Now, Catherine Burdekin is a very elusive figure who published under several names. It's not her birth name. Her birth name was Catherine Cade. She's the youngest sister of Rowena Cade, who founded the Minack Theatre. And sort of born at the end of the 19th century. It goes to Cheltenham Ladies College. Her family won't send her to Oxford. But she gets married, goes off to Australia, leaves the husband, comes back, moves in with a woman. Together they bring up her children. And through all this time, she's writing and writing and writing and writing. And in the 1930s, she publishes probably her best known book, which people may have heard of, under her pseudonym Murray Constantine. She publishes a book called Swastika Night, which is a grimly dystopian view of the Third Reich, 1,000 years time, and sort of traces the connections between misogyny and imperialism and militarism. Very, very, very good book. I came across this in what I think of as Peter Carey's big bumper book of utopian fun. You know, that fable book of utopias. Yeah. I'm kind of reading through that. And this one catches my eye. It's extremely... All these books are coming across as quite bleak. I am quite a happy person. Come on, this really shocking excerpt from Swastika Night. And I became fascinated by this writer. She's extremely difficult to track down. Swastika Night stays in print. It's the only one still in print. But by the 60s, she had completely disappeared by the time of her death. And she's found in one of these sort of literary treasure hunts by an American academic called Daphne Patai, who finds Swastika Night and reads it and thinks, there must be more of this. Tracks down the cottage where Cade lived with her partner until her death. Goes upstairs, finds this trunk, opens it up and finds almost a dozen unpublished novels. One of which she puts into print in the 80s called The End of This Day's Business, which is a kind of companion piece to Swastika Night. It's a feminist dystopia. What would it be like if women were running? Well, not as good. Either not as bad as Swastika Night by any means. But the book I picked is one called Proud Man. And this is another book from the 30s. And again, I think we're given what we're given in The Dispossessed. We're given an outsider's view of another world. In this case, Earth in the 1930s, that sort of low, dishonest decade. And a traveller comes back from the future, the person, from maybe 1,000 years in our future, from a world where fully realised people are androgynous, they self-fertilise, they're vegetarian. It's a little bit, you know... it's very 30s.
Yeah.
And what we see is the person's view of this terrible world that human beings are trying to struggle and live in.
Although which she calls I'm subhuman, which is what makes it so powerful, because she's sort of sketching out what perhaps human beings might evolve into. And there's all kinds of extraordinary stuff, isn't there? The fact that she can't believe that we have lost use, or we don't have the use of our senses, you know, that we can't hear properly and we can't taste properly. And we're locked into this very, very, she thinks, this very, very kind of unhappy making sexual dichotomy between men and women.
The opening section, which is almost like a long essay in a way, it goes through everything. You've got toxic masculinity, the fragility of masculinity, you've got the sexual double standard. It's all just laid down there. She had a fascinating writing style. Apparently her writing style was sort of automatic writing. She would kind of write a book in 5 or 6 weeks and then that was it. The book was done. And it means that she's patchy, but it also means that some of these, there are just these periods of real visionary quality. There's no other writer like her. I think she's fascinating. I'd love to get my hands on those other books. They're in I saw the archive up for sale in round about 2001, 2003, but I didn't have a spare 20K at the time. But I'll get to those books one day and write about her.
I know that some of them have been reissued by the Feminist Press. Proud Man is ostensibly available by Feminist Press in the US. I haven't.
And Golanks, who do a very good ebook range of out of print science fiction, have got. I think they've got Proud Man, Swastika Night, and The End of This Day's Business.
Under the name Murray Constantine.
Under Murray Constantine, yeah. It's SF Gateway is the ebook imprint. So those three 30s utopias, dystopias, you can kind of get your hands on.
I mean, you know, she should be read next to Huxley and Orwell, really, because this is a much more, it's a much subtler and more interesting. I'm sure you'll read us a bit, but Constantine also, I just discovered, she did that name, the identity wasn't until the 80s
when Daphne Patai does this sort of literary, you know, detective work and connects Constantine to the Cade name.
And when Proud Man was reviewed in 1934, a lot of people thought it was Olaf Stapleton, the sci-fi writer.
Yeah, exactly that.
Definitely a bloke.
Definitely a bloke. Yeah, it's Tiptree all over again, isn't it? Yeah. Something ineluctably masculine about this prose. Except it's by a woman. Yeah.
Yes. Why don't you read a little? I mean, I have to say, I was completely not sideways by this.
Had you read it before?
I've never heard of it, never read it before, and I'm interested in dystopian fantasy from that period, sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, and I'd never heard of Catherine Burdekin. So it's that thing, isn't it, that we think that the trans debate, such as it is today, this wasn't being had before. I mean, this is absolutely explicitly what this is about.
Absolutely.
You know, the polarity between the sexes is not as straightforward as it may appear.
Exactly that. And I think these histories get lost very quickly. And this is the value of going back to texts like these. You find these voices. If you can't find these voices around you, you have to go to the past and find them. And you can find a kind of continuity of being in them.
When the narrator in the book is a woman, there's a brilliant interview with a bishop, which just and he kept trying to deal with her worldview. It's beautifully done.
So I've picked a little bit that doesn't really, it sort of only tangentially takes us inside the mind of the person. It's while she's living as a woman and she's befriended another woman called Leonora, and one of the qualities that the person has is that they're able to sort of, as with many science fiction books, there's a kind of psychic abilities as well. And the person's able to sort of feel and hear what Leonora is thinking. So this is a glimpse into Leonora's mind and what the person notices about her. On the way to the park, she didn't talk very much, Leonora. Her thoughts were very jerky, for everything she saw and heard had a front place in them. Had she expressed them in words, they would have been something like this. This is a very peculiar woman, lovely and somehow good, and yet not good at all. I I am at ease with her. I shouldn't be with an ordinary good person. That man either drinks, has a weak heart or indigestion. His head is a fine shape. This bus is travelling very badly. Ethel's supposed to stop cars knocking. Could the LGOC afford Ethel? There's an awful green hat. Some women are colourblind. We know a certain amount of what Charlemagne did. We don't know at all about how he thought. How can one make him in a novel think enough like we think, and yet enough differently? Horns of Roland faintly blowing. Alethea Gifford Verona. Why Gifford? It isn't her real name. No, none of it. When people give their real names, they have a heightened consciousness of identity. She has none. What lovely skin she has. She makes that woman over there look like a Dutch doll. Yes, you, a silly Dutch doll. You look with jealous enmity at my lovely Alethea. I don't wonder. Why should she wear a hat if she doesn't want to? You could go up without a hat. Your hair's foul, stringy and greasy. That man's in trouble. His wife, his business or his children. It goes on a little bit like this. She's unique. I could tell her anything and know she would never be shocked and never be admiring. She's absolutely cold and pure and still. That Charmille novel won't do. It's silly and fussy and stupid. So we're inside Leonora's head there, and the person is sort of picking up the impressions of her mind.
It is such an odd, strange and compelling book. It really is. It's properly original. I haven't read anything like
it. It is, yeah. And it's this thing I'm saying with science fiction, that sometimes you forgive inelegancies because the ideas that you're getting. And almost that the inelegancies are part of it, because people are stretching their thinking, they're stretching their imagination, and language is harder to manipulate when you're doing that.
Yeah, and it gives you an insight into all kinds of more interesting debates taking place in the 1930s than perhaps the ones that have become the ones that have been signed off by the culture, as it were.
Exactly. Much more about gender and sexuality and gender expression. Yeah, a really interesting book and writer.
Right, we're coming up to the final choice, which is has to be one that is close to your heart. Introduced, bring on Vonda.
Bring on the great Vonda McIntyre.
Yeah.
So we've done a Doctor Who book on Backlisted. My God, now we're going to do a Star Trek book. So I've picked a wonderful novel, which is the novelisation of the movie Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Now, I'm sure that listeners to this podcast immediately are able to tell me which Star Trek film that one is. It is, of course, the one with the whales, yeah? It's the one where Kirk and Spock go back in time and kidnap a pair of humpback whales and bring them back to the future to save the Earth from destruction. That one, the one with the whales. Everyone knows the one with the whales. And it's a great film. It's loads of fun. It's an absolute joy.
Genuinely funny, as well. I mean, I did rewatch the movie for this podcast, and then cross checked it with to see whether favourite scenes were in the book, and most of them were, including perhaps my favourite line in any of the Star Trek films, which is when the cetologist asks Kirk. He said, "So what are you from? So what, you're telling me you're from outer space?" Kirk blew out his breath. "No," he said, "I'm from Iowa. I just work in outer space."
John, a line that I get to say surprisingly often. "No, I'm from St. Helens. I just work in outer space."
Work in outer space. I love it.
So I've picked this book because, this is where my career went. Yeah.
Yes. Some,
somehow all that youthful promise turned into writing Star Trek novels. I love this book, partly the reason I love it, it's fun, it's entertaining, it's got all the joy of the film. But then, because it's a novel, McIntyre has all these extra spaces in which to put her own sort of spin on the Star Trek universe. And what I love most about this book, it ends up decentering human beings completely. It ends up as a kind of peace treaty between two humpback whales and an ancient space intelligence. Yeah. And it's got nothing to do with the humans. The, you know, Spock is kind of brokering the treaties, like the middleman. But the humans are kind of peripheral to the end of this book. And in all ways, I think McIntyre is putting her vision of the future down on the page. And if I could sing the praises of Vonda McIntyre, we'll come to that in a minute, but I'll sing her praises very, very highly.
Well, I was going to ask you, because we should, I mean, she's pretty remarkable. She was the second woman to win a Nebula and the third to win the Hugo Award. She won a second Nebula. I love this. Her first one was in 1978 for Dream Snake. And then she won a second Nebula for a book that sounds amazing called The Moon and the Sun. And it beat George R.R. Martin's Game of Thrones.
It did. Yeah.
And it's described as an alternate history set in the court of Louis XIV, where the Sun King believes his immortality is assured if he devours the flesh of a sea creature.
It's a belting novel. It's absolutely
I've written it down. Sounds right.
Oh, just read all her books. I mean, from Dream Snake, which is a stone cold feminist classic, right up to The Moon and the Sun. There's a film got made of it, starring Pierce Brosnan, which is really, it's not very good, apparently. There's an unpublished novel, which I've read, called The Curve of the World, which is outstandingly good. It's a kind of life's work to get this book into print. It's about an ancient Minoan civilization. And you can kind of read it alongside The Dawn of Everything, Graeber and Wengrew. It's kind of novelising the ideas of that book. It's incredible. She was an outstandingly good writer. And that's the reason she got this gig. This was a high-profile gig to relaunch Star Trek as a major franchise. Roddenberry does the first novel of the first movie. And they look around, they go, who's the best science fiction writer in America at the moment? Vonda McIntyre. And they get her to do these three books of the next Star Trek 2, 3 and 4.
And they're in that great Simon Schuster pocketbook series that people
know and love and have written for.
just teeing you up there, but I just wanted to ask you about the process of, because I suppose that's for me is interesting, is that you've got the bare bones of the story there. But what you're saying is that what McIntyre does, and I mean, is that something you that excites you as well as a writer, that you've got a franchise, so people know who the kind of characters are, but how you are able to as it were, insert your own kind of creative and imaginative of vision.
Absolutely, and I think it was reading books like this that gave me the kind of courage to do that. That I could kind of go, you know, I don't just want these to be Star Trek novels. I want them to be my perspective on what matters about utopian fiction. Or, you know, these franchises have a long life for a reason. People love them. They want to be with these characters. They want to be in these situations. If I can sneak in a bit of, you know, anarchism or feminism or whatever I believe in and get that on the shelves of a Walmart in Oklahoma City, I think I've done my job.
But and that in a way it kind of links all these books, doesn't it? That I found a great quote that Theodore Sturgeon about science fiction said its prime function is to create other kinds of social systems to see how they would work or if they would work. That kind of that's in a way what you're saying is, although it may not seem that there's a political theme to even to Star Trek, but of course it's always there, because we're always projecting out from our own reality into what would an alternative reality look like. Would it
exactly
work?
That. Yeah. If Margaret Thatcher's saying there is no alternative, science fiction is saying, look, I've got half a dozen just here.
And if you don't like these, I've got others.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can just come up with something better, because you know, it's got to be better than this.
Do you want to read us a bit of Vonda's Deathless
Prose? I will. Vonda's phenomenal. We should also mention, we shouldn't forget, Handheld reprinted her first novel, The Exile Waiting, which is a companion.
That's Handheld Press, Kate McDonald's brilliant Handheld Press, who, again, friends of the show. But that's
very much so. And that's a companion piece to Dream Snake, which is her great novel. So I did want to mention that. But I'll just read you the very, very start of Star Trek The Voyage Home. So it's very pretty. And we are with the ancient space intelligence, just orientating people. The Traveller sang. Amid its complexities and its delicate, immensely long memories, it sang. In the complete cold of deep space, the song began at one extremity, spun in circles of superconducting power and speed, and evolved. It culminated in the traveller's heart, after a time counted not in micromeasures, but on the galactic scale of the formation of planets. The traveller sent each finished song into the vacuum. In return, it received new songs from other beings. Thus it wove a network of communication across the galaxy, oblivious to the distances it connected many species of sentient creatures, one with the other. From time to time, it discovered a newly evolved intelligence to add to its delicate fabric. On those rare occasions, it rejoiced. On much rarer occasions, it grieved.
Brilliant.
Lovely. She's so good. She's so good.
And that's obviously great tips there as well with for other Wanda McIntyre books, which are Dream Snake and The Exile Waiting, which is the one that's published by, first novel that's published by Handheld, and The Moon and the Sun, which is the alternate history set in the court of Louis XIV. Great. I mean, Una, new worlds and new civilizations. We boldly went. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. Yeah. So I just wanted to say thank you. What an amazing collection
of
books.
My pleasure. Wow, it's
great
fun.
We will obviously be putting links to all of them up on the website, as we normally do, and in our bookshop, our backlisted bookshop. So thank you to Una. Thank you also to Tess, who is Tess Davidson, who is standing in for Nikki today. She works with us as producer and researcher and many other things besides. So thank you, Tess. We, as you know, are technically on sabbatical, and we'll be back with normal service. Will be resumed in April. But in the meantime, there is nothing to stop you downloading all previous 176 or something episodes, links, clips, suggestions for further reading on our website, backlisted.fm. And we're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook, and indeed now on Instagram. You can also support us directly by supporting our Patreon at www.patreon.com/backlisted. For a modest sum, patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early and entirely advertising free. And those who've subscribed to the Lock Listener level get two whole extra podcasts each month. We call it Locklisted, and it features the three of us talking over books, films and music we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight. That, though, is the end of our backlisted science fiction special. Is there anything, Una, that you want to add? Anything else you want to throw in as a sort of a farewell observation?
Oh, I mean, I could talk about this stuff all night, so I better stop now.
Well, thank you. It's been fun. And look out for, we will be reissuing some of, at least one, possibly two more of older episodes before we return in April. And there will be one more, I think, at least one more special before that too. But thank you all for listening. See you all in a fortnight.